It brings rewards. Crowns speak of rule. Someone has said, oh, well, the only use for my crown, I'm going to throw it at his feet. Well, in that case, he could have given you a bag, a sack, or a box, or a jewel, or something like that. But a crown is a symbol. And it's not merely something in the case where they throw it at his feet. That is to acknowledge that all authority derives from him, and that we attribute all the glory connected with it to him. In other words, even the crown is by grace in every way. But it is still a symbol of rule. And so, here we find what we are doing now will carry over to the judgment seat of Christ. Rewards will be given. I believe those will be seen and operated in the millennial kingdom. If we suffer with him, we shall also reign with him. And from there, that goes out and reaches into the everlasting or eternal kingdom. We are not merely working for numbers in Pennsylvania, New York, Missouri, or wherever you happen to come from, Quebec even, and believe it or not, even PEI, Prince Edward Island, that stands for, or in the city of Belfast. Our work goes straight through into eternity. We are working out eternal purposes of God. That adds dignity to everything you do. It's not just a job to make a bigger number in a hall or a chapel. We are part of God's purposes for ages to come, and the echoes and results of that will be seen in ages to come, which is why Zechariah so often blends a view of the glory of the future with an exhortation to work in the present. Doesn't that add dignity to your work? Even a Sunday school class, going and giving a few words at an old folks' home to cheer them up, and they can hardly hear half you're saying, and yet you're comforting their hearts. But that's what he did. That's what the Lord did. He comforted hearts. And he wants us to use all the talents we have in whatever particular place he has put us. And he says, don't think that this just starts and ends here, and you got yourself buried, and they say he was a real good guy, he was a wonderful preacher, he was a wonderful visitor, he was a wonderful administrator at CMML or something of the kind, and then you get buried, and apart from a page or two in the magazines, that's it, finished. And you might not even get into the magazines, by the way. It depends on who you are. But the fact is, we are working in an eternal plan. We are contributing to the fulfillment of eternal purposes. You get hold of that, and it'll add dignity to whatever work you're doing. And I have to remind myself sometimes of this, because these days I spend quite a few hours of my days twisting my brains into knots, trying to retranslate and improve the Chokwe Bible. But we won't be talking Chokwe in heaven. I hardly think that that's going to be the lingua franca of the glory. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure what kind of language we'll speak. I suppose the Jews think it'll be Hebrew. But you see, that language may perish, but if some people are helped through those scriptures, and they work, and they lead other people to Christ, or they teach other people through it, or they build up the assemblies by ministering that word to God's people, that all carries over into eternity. That's the view we need to get hold of.
Could you repeat that again? You say it blends the work now for the future fulfillment of eternal plans? Is that the way you would say that? He blends the work now?
Yes. Everything we are now doing is part of the eternal plans and purposes of God. It's not just building up a chapel or a hall or a Sunday school class or whatever. It's all part of an eternal plan. And that, in turn, will merge through ages yet to come. We are fulfilling purposes of the Almighty. And that's what he wants us to see. Now, in view of that, of course, he has to tell us something about the future. Look at chapter 9. Now, you may have something that, in a moment or two, we're going to give you the liberty to do this, but for the present, to try to follow out these thoughts of mine, look at the beginning of chapter 9. The burden of the word of the Lord in the land of Hadrach and Damascus shall be its rest. The burden of the word of the Lord in the land of Hadrach and Damascus shall be at rest when the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward the Lord. And Hamath also shall border by it, Tyre and Sidon, though it be very wise. And Tyre did build herself a stronghold and heaped up silver like dust and fine gold like the mire of the street. Behold, the Lord will cast her out, and he will smite her power in the sea, and she shall be devoured with fire. That's the land to the north. Hamath, of course, is up toward Syria on the borders of that, to the east. Ascalon, now he's coming down to the Philistine country. Ashkelon shall see it and fear. Gaza also shall see it and be very sorrowful. And Ekron, for her expectation, shall be ashamed, and the king shall perish from Gaza. And Ashkelon shall not be inhabited, and a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines. I will take away his blood out of his mouth and his abominations from between his teeth. He that remaineth, even he, shall be for our God, and he shall be like a governor in Judah, and Ekron shall be a Jebusite. How do you like that? And I will encamp about mine house because of the army, because of him that passeth by, and because of him that returneth, and no oppressor shall pass through them any more. For now I have seen with mine eyes. No wonder the next verse says, Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just, and having salvation, lowly, and riding upon an ass, and upon a colt, the foal of an ass. We must pause there. The reason he starts talking about these places, that is, Tyre up in the north, and Hamath over to the right, to the northeast, then down to the bottom. These will all be included in the kingdom promised to David and occupied by David and Solomon. They will all be part of the central Holy Land. But far more than that, Christ is going to rule over all the nations, every one of them. Now he goes back. Who is going to do this? And this is what brings the great jump here. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Here's the one who's going to do it. Thy king cometh unto thee. Did they have any real thought of a king coming to this little temple they were building with 50,000 people in the midst of Samaritan enemies? Did they think there was going to be a king there? No, they couldn't. There was no hope of that. And they've never had a king since. And they never will have. They never will have. They'll have a false prophet, all right. And he will lead them into them and all the rest into the signing of a treaty, because he sets up the image in the temple in Jerusalem, and I would suggest that he must be an apostate Jew to do that. The second beast I'm referring to. Isn't it a horrible thought that God's own people, in God's own temple, though they will build it and he will not recognize as such, but they will call it the temple, and that is the very place where the image of the first beast is set up, and they are called upon to worship it on pain of death. The mind just boggles at this. A people who had been saved from idolatry, and now the very what should we call it? The top of the whole business, the highest point of idolatry, is going to be in the temple, called the temple of God in Jerusalem. And he is saying, I am God. At least the other one. He's going to make everybody bow down to the first beast. They don't bow to him. So he has to tell them how this is all going to come about. The king comes. He's meek and lowly. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem. The battle bow shall be cut off. He shall speak peace to the nations. His dominion shall be from sea even to sea. Take a look at that in your maps. From sea to sea in the land of Palestine. And from the river even to the ends of the earth. The river, when it's used in that sense, not the river of Egypt, but the river, is usually the Euphrates. The word Euphrates is simply the Syrian word for, the Aramaic word for the river. The river. So, from sea to sea, and from the great river to the ends of the earth. As for thee also, by the blood of thy covenant I have sent forth thy prisoners out of the pit in which is no water. Turn to the stronghold, ye prisoners of hope. Even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee. When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece, and make thee like the sword of a mighty man, and the Lord shall be seen over them, and his arrow shall go forth like the lightning. And the Lord God shall blow the trumpet, and shall go with whirlwinds of the south. The Lord of hosts shall defend them, and they shall devour and subdue the sling stones. They shall drink and make a noise as though with wine, as through wine, and they shall be filled like bowls and like the corners of the altar. And the Lord their God shall save them in that day as the flock of his people. For they shall be like the stones of a crown, that is the precious stones, lifted up as an ensign unto his land. Note, his land. For how great is his goodness and how great is his beauty. Grain shall make the young men cheerful, and new wine the maids. These are wonderful poetic pen pictures of things to come. And when I get a bit downcast with politics around about me these days, this is the kind of thing that I like to turn to. What God is going to make this world. And it will not be your president who will do it. And it will not be John Major who will do it. And it will not be the Pope who will do it. Nor any of the great leaders of the world today. It will be the King when he comes. And he comes first in judgment. And he breaks the nations. Pushes back their borders, gives Israel her full possession of the land, and then extension well beyond the land that he has ever promised. And of course, that's the point at which we read in other places that even the brute creation, the lion and the lamb lie down together, all war is cancelled out. We should come to some things about that. But there are some very, very sad things that have to happen in between. Anybody got any suggestions, any thoughts about any of this before we go on? There'll be time, of course, at the end as well. But I know some of you are looking a bit sleepy, but... Right, Bill.
What does it mean from... Yes.
In Bill Spry, Zechariah 9, end of verse 10, He shall speak peace to the nations, and his dominion shall be from sea to sea. What's from sea to sea?
I think it's from the Mediterranean to the Gulf of Aqaba. For one thing, you see, he says in another place, well, maybe there's something about it here, but certainly he says several times, it's in Ezekiel, there is going to be a river, and it will come out from underneath the temple, and part of it will flow to the hinder sea, and part of it will flow to the former sea. That can only be one branch of this river will flow northwest into the Mediterranean, and the other will flow southeast, and the only place it can flow is into the Gulf of Aqaba and the Red Sea.
That means the Dead Sea has to be done away with?
The Dead Sea is going to be lifted up, and there will be no Dead Sea. It says there will be fish there, the same as the fish in the Mediterranean. It will be clean water, not salt water. You can practically walk on the Dead Sea now. As a matter of fact, the Israeli people are drying up the southern part of the Dead Sea right now. Each time I have gone, if you remember the shape of the Dead Sea, when you come down, the Jordan comes down like this, and it moves out into the main body, then there's a place where two peaks of the shore come out, and a narrowed part, and then there's another little blob of the... Now, they say that that wasn't part of the original Dead Sea at all. That's the water that engulfed Sodom and Gomorrah after the violent earthquake and belching of salts, mineral salts all over the place, you remember, that engulfed Lot's wife. And so for years now they have been putting a dam across that narrow part and closing off as much of the water that's flowing into it from the upper part, closing that off and drying the lower part up so that they can salvage and take out the chemical salts without having to pump them as water. They'll be able to scrape them out dry and put them straight into the factories, the refineries rather. So that the Dead Sea itself is being made smaller all the time, and that deliberately by the Israelis. One, they want to get out the salts down there. Which, of course, it'll now be hundreds of feet deep, thick. By the way, the depth is another indication. The Dead Sea is very deep at the upper end of it. I've forgotten what depth is, over 1,000 feet deep. But when you come down to that lower part of it, it's only about 15 feet deep. It's quite shallow. So that, I believe, will gradually disappear. But another reason is that they want to try to back the waters of the Dead Sea up a bit to stop the flow from the Sea of Galilee, which is being exhausted of its fresh water flowing into the Dead Sea. Yes, Eric.
Eric, in the 9th verse, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, and upon a colt, the fold of an ass. Would I be correct in saying that this prophecy has been fulfilled when the Lord rode into Jerusalem on the colt of an ass?
Yes.
And am I right again in saying that this is the animal that the king used when he was doing his business? We find from David, and Absalom was on the ass when he was caught by his hair in the bough of the tree.
Yeah.
And by this, they knew when they waved their palms and they hailed him that he was the rightful king that came into their midst that day.
Right. But they murdered him, and the kingdom was put in abeyance, postponed. So the literal kingdom and its aspirations stopped when Israel murdered her Messiah. But he'll come back again.
Now, maybe it's the way that the Bible has been written up. I know in other translations it doesn't read this way, but when we get into the Gospels, and John, it says of him, King of the Jews. And I find that each time that statement is used, King of the Jews, It's always the Gentiles that use it. At his birth, it was the King of the Jews. But when he was upon the cross, the chief priest sat down and said, King of Israel. Can I make a difference here in the way that it's written up?
I thought that the chief, you mean when they came to Herod? When the chief Jews came to Herod.
Was he as King of the Jews?
I think what they said was, put up there, not King of the Jews, but he said, I am King of the Jews.
Above the cross.
But each time in that scene from the beginning, it's always something to do with the Gentiles that says, again, he said, the Jews said, he's King of the Jews. Where is he that is King of the Jews? He's always the King of the Jews, but until the crucifixion, when he was upon the cross, the Lord, the Pharisees, the scribes, whoever sat down and said, if thou be the King of Israel, come down from the cross and save thyself.
Well, of course, they didn't like the word Jew anyway. Jew simply comes from the word Jude. It's from a Judean,
Judea.
And it was a kind of a slur word, whereas Israel, that's hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one God. So Israel to them was a much more, it had to do with their king, their kingdom. But they denied him, said, we have no king but Caesar. We have no king but Caesar. Well, it's time. Oh, is there quite another question? No. 3:45?
Yes.
Yes. Time for a break. Well, I've stopped on time. The tragedy of Israel murdering her own king and thus sealing her own doom for these 2,000 years just staggers the mind. He came, he presented himself, he fulfilled every promise. They spat in his face. They nailed him to a stake. That's what the word cross means. It wasn't necessarily a cross like this. That was added from pagan religions afterwards. It was a hideous thing. The word staurus means a stake, a post, a pillar. And they nailed him that whatever way they nailed him. And they jeered and taunted him while he died. Something which I hope any sensible parent would punish their child for doing to a dying alley cat. You say, leave it alone. Let the thing die. But no, they taunted him. Is it any wonder God in heaven has promised judgment on them for that? And that he himself said, if thou hadst known, even in this thy day, the things that belong unto thy peace. He just couldn't understand. Well, he understood, sorry. But humanly speaking, it was beyond even imagination that this could happen. And so, Zechariah touches on his coming. Then he jumps forward to future deliverance of Judah and Ephraim, which of course is Israel, the northern kingdom. Speaks of cutting off the chariot and so on. And then again in chapter 10, he goes into the dispersion. Ask of the Lord rain in the time of the latter rain, so the Lord shall make bright clouds and give them showers of rain to everyone, grass in the field. For the idols have spoken vanity, the diviners have seen a lie, and have told false dreams. They comfort in vain, therefore they went their way like a flock, They were troubled because there was no shepherd. Mine anger was kindled against the shepherds, and I punished the goats, for the Lord of hosts hath visited his flock, the house of Judah, and hath made them as his majestic horse in the battle. Out of him came forth the corner, out of him the nail, out of him the battle bow, out of him every oppressor together. And they shall be like mighty men who tread down their enemies in the mire of the street, in the streets in the battle. And they shall fight because the Lord is with them, and the riders and horses shall be confounded. And I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph, and I will bring them again to place them, for I have mercy upon them, and they shall be as though I had not cast them off. For I am the Lord. Don't you wonder how people can read this and say there's no future for Israel? It's an amazing thing. Bible students, you know. God's finished with them. We're Israel. We're the Israel of God. And all the promises to Israel are really our promises, and that's that. They of Israel shall be like a mighty man. Their hearts shall rejoice as through wine. Yea, their children shall see it and be glad. Their hearts shall rejoice in the Lord. I will hiss for them, gather them, for I have redeemed them. They that increase, and they shall increase as they have increased. That will go on. God will fill the land with them. I will sow them among the nations, the peoples, the Gentiles, the Goyim. By the way, did you know that's where your word guy comes from? That's one word, one reason I never use it. The word guy comes from the Hebrew word goy, which means a Gentile, and it's a sneer word, an uncircumcised goy. And so the Jews around about New York, first of all, when they were referring to some Gentile who, in spite of being a Gentile, wasn't a bad goy, you simply took up the word goy and made it guy, and you're still using it. So that's what you're calling each other. Goyim is simply the plural of the Hebrew word. Goyim, the Gentile. Hey, Gentile, come here. Open thy doors, O Lebanon, chapter 11. The fire may devour thy cedars. Wail, fir tree, for the cedar is fallen, because the mighty are spoiled. Wail, O ye oaks of Bashan. The forest of the vintage is come down. There is a voice of the wailing of the shepherds. Their glory is spoiled. This is the tribulation, of course. The young lions, a voice of the roaring of young lions, for the pride of the Jordan is spoiled. Thus saith the Lord my God, feed the flock of the slaughter. Whose possessors slay them, hold themselves not guilty. And they that sell them say, blessed be the Lord, for I am rich. It's the way the Jews are behaving in this age. Whatever they do, it's all right, bless the Lord, I'm rich. And their own shepherds pity them not. For I will no more pity the inhabitants of the land, saith the Lord. Lo, I will deliver the men, every one, into his neighbor's hands and into the hand of his king. They shall smite the land, and out of their hand I will not deliver them. And I will feed the flock of slaughter, even you, O poor of the flock, I will. And I took unto me two sticks, the one I called Beauty, and the other Bands, and I fed the flock. Three shepherds also I cut off in 1 month. My soul loathed them, and their soul also abhorred me. Then said I will not feed you. That which dieth, let it die. That which is cut off, let it be cut off. And let the rest eat, everyone, the flesh of another. That's dire situations, absolute disaster. It was, And I took my staff, even beauty, and cut it asunder, that I might break my covenant, which I had made with all the peoples. And it was broken in that day, so the poor of the flock that waited upon me knew that it was the word of the Lord. I said unto them, if you think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said unto me, cast it unto a potter, a lordly price that I was prized at of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Then I cut asunder mine other staff, even bands, that I might break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. He's used this picture before, by the way, of the two sticks and breaking them, speaking in all probability of the two lands, but of his oath and covenant with them. Now he breaks that all down because he's going to join them. And the Lord said unto me, take unto thee yet the instruments of a foolish shepherd. For lo, I will raise up a shepherd in the land who shall not visit those that are cut off, neither shall seek the young one, nor heal that which is broken, nor feed that which standeth still, but he shall eat their flesh of the fat and tear their claws in pieces. Woe to the idle shepherd that leaveth the flock. The sword shall be upon his arm and upon his right eye, and his arm shall be completely dried up, and his right eye shall be utterly darkened. Just keep that in mind, because I think you're going to bump into it again. Chapters 9 to 11 in your lesson are marked out as world power over Israel is destroyed. Chapters 12 to 14, the summary is Israel is sifted, brought to repentance, and purged. Read chapter 12, verse 10 to 14. I will come to that in a moment. And 13:1, a fountain opened. So now we're into the portion where Israel is sifted or put through the mill, and then comes the fountain opened at 13:1. In that day there shall be a fountain opened to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. Now that is undoubtedly the turning point in the whole thing. But here, Judah, Jerusalem is attacked. The burden of the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord, who stretched forth the heavens, layeth the foundations of the earth, formeth the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling to all peoples round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all peoples. Could you think of a neater description of what Israel is to the nations today? Nobody wants anything to do with the Israeli problem because they don't know how to handle it. They're afraid. They're scared out of their wits. They don't know what to do about Israel. America gives them a lot of money, of course, because of the many millions of Jews that are in America, in the United States, that is, I should say. But they try to get them together, and then when they get them together, the whole thing starts wobbling all over the place, and they don't know who to back and who not to back. Britain has always played a cat and mouse job, and a very indecent one at that. Some of their dealings with Israel have been very, very shameful. Other nations, of course, just solve the Jewish problem by trying to exterminate them. But no matter how you look at it, Israel is a heavy stone to everybody round about. Nobody knows how to solve it. As a matter of fact, I don't think there is a solution for it, apart from God's. And isn't it amazing, when you look at the size of that little piece, what is all the fuss about? I mean, here are the Arabs. They have hundreds of thousands and hundreds of thousands of square miles of territory. They have oil, and of course, Israel has none. As a matter of fact, one of our tour guides on one of the trips that I took there said, "You know the biggest mistake Moses ever made? He made a mistake when he brought the children of Israel out of Egypt. He turned left instead of right and missed the oil fields." Israel hasn't a scrap of oil in the whole place, at least so far. Now, this is one of the things they have hopes about for the south of the Dead Sea. You remember, it's called the slime pits in the Battle of the Kings, the five kings against four kings, and it talks, actually, that's bitumen. And wherever there's bitumen, there's likely to be oil. And that's another of the reasons why they want to dry up that southern part of the lake where all the salts are. That's not table salt nor Epsom salts either for that part. It's 12, at least 12 chemical salts that are very, very precious and have a lot of income for Israel. But they are hoping that underneath these salts and the bitumen deposits that there just might be oil. And if they discover oil, then the Arabs will be on top of them for it. That could very easily be a trigger in what lies ahead. But I ain't no prophet, and I ain't prophesying neither. "Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling to all the peoples round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all peoples. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the nations of the earth be gathered together against it. In that day, saith the Lord, I will smite every horse with terror and his rider with madness. I will open mine eyes upon the house of Judah and smite every horse of the peoples with blindness. The governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be my strength and the Lord of hosts their God. In that day will I make the governors of Judah like a hearth of fire among the wood, and like a torch of fire in a sheaf. They shall devour all the peoples round about, on the right hand and on the left." Now, they've done a pretty good job in that so far, but that's nothing to the future. "Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. The Lord shall save the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah. In that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. He that is feeble among them at that day shall be like David, and the house of David shall be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications. They shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, shall be in bitterness for him or because of him, as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn." Notice, by the way, here it says Jehovah is the one who's speaking, and he says they shall look on me whom they have pierced, but it was the Lord Jesus whom they pierced. He and Jehovah are one. That's one of those coincidental proofs of the full deity of Christ. They shall look on me whom they pierced. But of course, when we get it in the New Testament, it says they shall look on him whom they pierced.
You might have heard this. You correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm going to mention someone's name. But I think I remember Boyd Nicholson, a man I've never met, but on tape, speaking of this verse. and he said that a thought was that in a sense it was also the father that was pierced. When they pierced the son, the father was pierced, and then because it's as if this father is speaking, because they said that they shall mourn for him, and that's the son. I was just, I don't know.
Could be.
Could that be? I don't know if you'd ever heard that.
Well, I wouldn't.
It was a tremendous thought.
Yes, it is. But there are several other occasions where we have the same kind of thing in the New Testament, where that which is specifically spoken of God himself, Jehovah the Lord, in the Old Testament, the New Testament, and even the Lord himself claims that it was spoken of him. John chapter 12, he speaks of what was said when he saw his glory, speaking of Christ. But it was the Lord on the throne whom he saw. Harden their hearts, blind their eyes, stop their ears, so that they mayn't believe, so that judgment might fall upon them to the uttermost. And there are many other instances where we have that.
When Paul quotes that in Acts, it's the Holy Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same, one is the Father, one is the Son, and one is the Holy Ghost.
Right. No, he's finished. Don't give it back to him.
You're right about being finished.
So he's going to pour out upon this on the house of David this. Now, he mentions here that it will be a spirit of grace and of supplications. And then it is confession of sin. They will look on me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, shall be in bitterness. They will realize then what they have done. And in that day shall there be a great mourning in Jerusalem, as the mourning of Hadad Rimmon in the valley of Megiddo, or Megiddon is called here. I think this we can associate with Isaiah 53. We quote and use Isaiah 53, of course, or Isaiah 53, as a gospel message, and that's all right. You can apply it and use it in that way. Hundreds, maybe thousands of people have been saved. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. But as I mentioned the other day, to me it's perfectly clear from the context that this is going to be the prayer and the statement of Israel in a day yet to come. If you read it down in its context, and it's a context of a Jewish prophet, and he's talking about the Jewish people. And he said, there is no beauty in him when we shall see him. There's no beauty in him when they see him. There's no beauty in him. We turned away our faces from, we turned our heads away from him. We refused to listen to him. We thought that he was smitten of God. In other words, getting what he deserved, punished. We thought he was being punished by God, getting exactly what he deserved. He was a rabble-rouser, he was a deceiver, and he got what was coming to him. But, it was for our transgressions that he was pierced. It was for our iniquities that he was crushed, not bruised, but crushed. Pierced and crushed. The one refers to, awake, O sword, against the shepherd. Smite the man that is my shepherd, and so on. Pierced, awake, O sword, and crushed beneath the burden of sin for our transgressions, for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. He wasn't getting what he deserved. And with his stripes, with his lashings, we are healed. Now, I don't think those were the lashings merely of the whip. I think that was the punishment of God on his son. So dreadful that it's hard to find words to describe it, but it has to be described in terms which we can understand as punishment. But I don't think it was Herod's flogging of the Lord Jesus that removed any sins of mine or yours either, because Herod couldn't put the sins on him, neither could Pilate, neither the one nor the other. I think that was speaking of something even more terrifying that God was punishing his sins. And they're saying this. Now the light has dawned. He shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. Now I think that is a parallel passage to this, and it's because the spirit of grace, Godward, and supplications, manward, that is, grace on the part of God, supplication on the part of Israel, and this is what brings about their salvation. The family of the house of there shall be a great mourning everywhere. The family of the house of David apart, their wives apart. The family of Nathan apart, and their wives. He was a prophet. The family of the house of Levi apart, their